Thanks. Thanks, and thank you for the opportunity to speak here. The story that I'm going to tell you about today is a result of some work that I've done in collaboration with Asa Auerbach and Dana Robas. That's this first paper. The second paper is something I did with Subir Sachdev, and I'll also tell you about some ongoing work right now. And sort of the subtitle of this talk is that there's still surprises to be found in phi to the fourth theory. Okay, so you might think that after all these years of solving phi to the fourth theory, everything would be understood, but there's some things that I think are being appreciated now, and they have some experimental consequences. So just as a small of background, I'm going to tell you about a case of a three-dimensional system, which is a dimerized antiferromagnet, thallium copper chloride. And so this is just to sort of tell you what is the Higgs, sort of the case that's very easy to understand, what it looks like. The bulk of my talk is going to be the other two questions, which are can the Higgs be seen in two-dimensional systems? And the third is, does it survive near a quantum critical point? Okay, so this material, thallium copper chloride, it's a spin 1/2 antiferromagnet. So what you have is, this is schematic because the actual lattice is three-dimensional, but schematically, if you want to draw it in 2D, it would look something like this. You have sites of so you have spins at these sites, and the structure of the lattice is such that these bonds have different coupling constants. So if you write down a Heisenberg model for this, what you would have is some sum over sites of some jij, which is bond dependent, si dot sj. And the j's are basically you have stronger j's along this bond, so that I'll call that j. Here you have two weaker bonds, j prime and j double prime. Okay, so along the so if I continue it one more direction, these are the strong bonds. And so what happens is that depending on the values of j, j prime, and j double prime, the ground state can change in character. Okay, so
simple cubic lattice?
Huh?
Is it simple cubic?
I think it is simple cubic, yes. Mm-hmm. And so it's certainly bipartite, but I also think it's simple cubic. So what happens is that you can think of when j is dominant over j prime and j double prime, you prefer to make singlets along these strong bonds. And so then this would be the ground state. But if you choose a different arrangement of j's, then what you get is instead an antiferromagnet.
Arrangement
of
different sides?
Sorry? No, if all the j's were equal, then you would get an antiferromagnet. So you don't have to have different signs, just the magnitudes matter, the relative magnitudes. And what's nice about this material is that you can tune the different magnitudes by applying hydrostatic pressure. So you can undergo a transition between these two states just tuned by pressure. So basically, these jij's are functions of pressure. And what the phase diagram looks like is, as you apply pressure, temperature, you get that at some critical pressure, which is about, I think, 1 gigapascal, so you go from, which way does this go? So here you get the antiferromagnet. This state on the left does not break any symmetries, okay? Because even though you're making these valence bonds, there's one per unit cell. So this is not a spontaneously broken symmetry state, okay? So you go from a state that's just a paramagnet, a quantum paramagnet, to a nail state, okay? So these experiments were done by the Christian Ruge et al. PRL 100 2001. Okay. So basically, if you want to understand, the physics close to this quantum critical point, one can go into a continuum theory. So the order parameter here is a nail vector, which is a three-component vector, and you can write down an effective theory. So this is your order parameter, and the action for the order parameter would look something like integral v3 plus 1 x, so 1 half d mu by a squared minus some u over 2 by a squared minus 1 over g squared, okay, where basically this is some stiffness that this is some stiffness for, you know, the nail vector that wants to be uniform, and here this is basically a Mexican hat potential, okay? So close enough to the critical point, so let me call this v phi. And so v of phi looks something like this. So this is v. Here I'm just going to write phi x, but this thing is really spherically symmetric. So here you have that this potential has this Mexican hat shape. And so you expect from this that you would have two collective modes in the low energy theory.
This U is related to this JJ prime and J double prime.
Yeah, it's related to all of them. Mm-hmm.
Is it a simple way to write it, how they are related?
You have to basically go to the continuum limit, and close enough, far from the critical point, it will be basically J, but closer to the critical point, all these parameters will also depend on the difference between different J's.
The system is two-dimensional or three-dimensional?
The system is three-dimensional. So this is just a schematic because I cannot draw the three-dimensional structure. This is one plane, but there's other, right, it's stacked, so.
You have a J-curve as well?
Yeah, also, but I'm not going into the details. So I just want to talk about the field theory, so I don't want to, clearly you just have two phases, and what I want to concentrate on is on the field theory, just to show what happens, at the qualitative level, but.
It's important to understand whether this model is related to this particular system or not.
Near the critical point, it is. It's just due to universality, right? Near the critical point, you have a transition between an L state with this order parameter and a paramagnet, and you have this. In principle, you would have higher powers of phi, but those are less relevant. So this is the theory for the critical point. So. Basically, in here you have two types of modes. You have a mode that's...
Don't you have different couplings in different directions?
So yeah, so in principle this, in principle the kinetic term would be at a tensor, it would be some, I agree. I mean, I'm writing the most important parts, but this anisotropy is not important for.
Sorry, this is sigma model, so you feel this constraint, right?
No constraint. This is a soft spin, phi to the fourth soft spin. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically, the order parameter wants to have this magnitude, but it's allowed to fluctuate in amplitude. And precisely because of that, you have one gap mode, which corresponds to motion along the rim of the hat in the radial direction. So this is a gap mode because there's some curvature to the potential here. So this mode is what I call the Higgs Okay. In addition, you also have gapless Wilson modes, which are modes that correspond to fluctuations along the rim of the Mexican hat. So in this case, you will get two Wilson modes. So you have you have some spontaneous symmetry in this direction, and you have Wilson modes corresponding to elastic deformations like this and like that. But you also have a Higgs mode, which is fluctuations in the amplitude of the other parameter.
Your spin vector is two-dimensional or three-dimensional?
3D. So this is, here I'm just showing two of the three because I cannot draw. But this is really spherically.
The spin is isotropic.
Yeah, the spin is isotropic. Actually, in this system, there's only a U1 symmetry. So this is really not, this should have been a two-dimensional vector, but okay. So these are Wilson modes. This is Higgs, and just in terms of why this is called Higgs, this is really the analog of the Higgs particle in high energy. Okay, there's a Higgs particle and the Higgs mechanism, and these are two different things, so this can be confusing. But here I'm talking about a system without any gauge fields. Okay, and still. In the high energy Higgs is the amplitude mode of the order parameter and has nothing to do with the gauge fields. Okay, so the gauge fields are what give you the W and the Z when they eat up the Wilson modes. But then in addition, there's the Higgs, which is the mode, which is the oscillations of the order parameter magnitude. Okay, so.
It is high energy world without gauge fields and without fermions.
Exactly. So, okay. So now.
But is it serious? Is it relativistically invariant or not?
Yeah, the effective theory is relativistically invariant, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's essential.
That is essential. That is essential. I mean, but for n equals 3, it's hard to make it non relativistic, right? Like, unless if you have Berry spaces and things. So, okay. So this is basically what I'm calling the Higgs. This is what I call the Goldstone. Actually, these modes can be seen by expanding the order parameter about the minimum of the potential. So basically, if you write phi A equals phi X. Sorry, let me write it in this slide. Okay. So 1 over square root of G plus sigma, comma, phi 1, phi 2. Okay. So here I've chosen one of the minima of this potential. So I've chosen spontaneously broken the symmetry so that my order parameter is pointing along the x direction. So here I'm just drawing the rim of the Mexican hat from above. And so this is my minimum, and I've chosen this to be sigma, and this is pi. Okay, so these are fluctuations of the order parameter about its minimum value. Okay. So what you can do is you can substitute this back into the action, and what you get is some 1/2 integral V3 plus 1x.
But now pi 1 and pi 2 are not Goldstone modes because they also change the length of the vector.
But they are Goldstone modes. I mean, you'll see now what you can think about them.
I think that this one is very soft and this one is very hard. So.
That's right.
No, but still, I mean, if you have some fluctuation in pi 1 and pi 2, the length of the vector will change.
Absolutely, and that's what's going to give you a coupling between sigma and pi in the action. Okay, so maybe let me write this and then we'll. So basically, this is This is del mu pi 1 and pi 2 squared plus del mu sigma squared minus some m squared sigma squared plus some s and harmonic. Here m squared is just equal to 4u over g. Okay? And S and harmonic is integral d3 plus 1x of some minus 2u over root g sigma pi squared plus other anharmonicities which are less important than this one.
Okay? What is the reason you use the Cartesian coordinates rather than polar coordinates.
Well, this is right. This is the standard thing to do. Okay, well, later we'll use polar coordinates, but polar coordinates, there's a bit of an issue with just that what happens at the origin. Okay, like there's a singularity in the coordinate representation. What happens at the origin of a coordinate? So it's more standard to do this. Okay.
But is it correct that if you use polar coordinates, mm-hmm. then you have a clear separation between the massive.
Yeah, and this will play.
This is almost polar coordinate, no. Because if you say pi, it is just the angle and.
But it's not. It's not. This is the reason why you get some coupling between the two.
Right, but this is so. I think that the relationship between the two coordinates will become clear because I will come back to polar coordinates. That will play an important role. But for now, this is sort of the standard way to do this, and. And so what you see is that indeed at this level you have that phi doesn't have a mass, so it looks like a massless field. So these are the Goldstones. Sigma has a mass term, so this is the Higgs. But there is this coupling, and there's other couplings, higher order couplings.
And it will be important, this coupling.
Yeah, it will be in a second, because basically the point is this: that if you write down the dispersion.
Now it's not in the Euclidean space. You are doing it.
Right now, I wrote it in real space, real space time, Minkowski space. So here, the Higgs dispersion looks like this. The Goldstone dispersion looks like that. Okay. And so what this means is that, in principle, from a kinematic point of view, it's possible for a Higgs to decay into pairs of Goldstone modes, because you can take a single Higgs and split it into a pair of counterpropagating Goldstone modes, okay? And that this will have total k equals zero, and provided that this point is at half of that height, you have that you've also satisfied energy conservation, okay?
Is it, I understand that the Goldstone starts linear,
right?
But eventually it may curve because you may have some higher energy.
Yes, eventually it will curve, right?
But
eventually
it will curve. It's not linear all the way.
It's not linear all the way, as you get closer and closer to a critical point, you know, I mean, I'm just focusing near k equals zero, and then, you know. But yes, it does curve. But the curvature doesn't matter because you can still satisfy, unless if it curves so much that you don't have any modes at, you know, half of omega. Yeah. So, okay. So basically here, this what this tells you is that the Higgs is not a sharp interaction. Okay, it's not like a perfectly well-defined particle because it has a finite lifetime. Okay, and it's not just that you can satisfy energy momentum conservation, but it's also that there's a matrix element sigma pi squared that allows a Higgs to decay into pairs of Goldstones. So this tells you that the Higgs has a finite lifetime. So the question is, what is its lifetime? Okay.
But sorry for personal that. I mean, uh-huh. Had you started with the polar coordinates, then this massive radial mode will be completely decoupled from.
Yes.
And then this massive radial mode will have no decay.
Well, it will have a decay. It will have a weaker decay. Because you still have this, I assure you, you'll be happy with the answers at the end of the. Because actually, all of these things correspond to different physical experiments you can make. Okay, so what I'm walking you through is relevant to neutron scattering experiments. Okay, but going back to no coupling, you still have a coupling. Like if you go to polar coordinates, you would say that phi is equal to 1 over root g times square root of 1 plus rho, let's say, times n hat. Okay, this is a polar. This would be the polar representation. And in this polar representation, what you get is that the action gets terms like these. Okay, so it's not decoupled completely.
And this is sigma model.
Not yet, because rho is dynamic.
Yeah, if you integrate
over, I guess. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. If you integrate over rho, which is massive, then you'll end up with a sigma model. Yeah. Okay. So the question is, okay, so we said the Higgs has a finite lifetime. Now, what is this lifetime? So to compute that, one way is basically to write down the sigma sigma correlation function. So this is like this is a retarded sigma sigma correlation function, and what you find, so here in general it has this form I over k squared minus m squared minus sigma I call it sigma this minus the self energy of k, okay, and then to lowest order and perturbation theory, you can see that the simplest thing that you can do is a sigma can split into a pair of so this is my sigma field, and it can split into a pair of pi fields. Mm-hmm. So pi. Okay. And so here, if this has an external momentum k going through, then here you will get k plus q, here you'll get q in the opposite direction, and then k comes out. And so this thing, I'm not going to write all the coefficients, but this thing goes like d 3 plus 1 q divided by these propagators. These are massless propagators, so you get here q squared and q plus k squared. Okay. And so so what you see is you have this integral before q over q to the fourth, so this is a logarithmically divergent integral that gets cut off at high energies by the intrinsic cutoff of the theory, the ultraviolet cutoff of the theory. So this is those like a logarithm of lambda divided by, and then at short q's, this is cut off by k. So you have lambda over k. Okay. Actually, I should be a bit careful because I did this calculation assuming that these are Euclidean momenta. Okay, so. So actually, if I want to go back to a real,
do you assume Lorentz invariance?
Or? Yes. The theory becomes Lorentz invariant close to the critical point. This is something you can show.
Is it Lorentz invariant for this magnet?
Yeah, for the anti-ferromagnet it is. For a ferromagnet it would not be, but for the anti-ferromagnet, in principle you have terms that break Lorentz invariance, but they're all irrelevant. So. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so, I guess let me just indicate that this is Euclidean momentum. But if we want to go back to real momentum, we have to. Let's look at this at real momentum equals zero, and this k Euclidean goes to minus I omega, because this k was really a core vector. Okay, so if we do that, what we get is that the imaginary part of sigma at k equals minus I omega. So when you go to k equals minus I omega, you get here that the imaginary part of the logarithm is just pi. Okay. So this is log of a complex number, but the imaginary part is just pi, so this is just a constant. Okay. So so in other words, in three dimensions, this mode has a finite lifetime, but the finite lifetime is whatever it is, it's not it's it doesn't have any anyways, it's some number. And what that means is that if you look at the imaginary part of chi sigma sigma, it's a function of omega, it looks something like this. So this is the lambda, which and lambda is is whatever you get from doing this integral. Okay. So
this is bosonic mode, right?
Yeah, this is a bosonic mode. So this is the finite lifetime that you got from the fact that the Higgs can decay into pairs of Poisson modes. Okay. Mm-hmm. But now, one question is what happens as you get closer and closer to the critical? So as you approach the critical point, this triples one dimensions is the upper critical dimension of phi to the fourth theory. Okay, so what that means is that the critical point is actually a Gaussian, it's a Gaussian fixed point. So basically,
modulo logarithmic corrections. Modulo logarithmic corrections.
Exactly. So it's modulo logarithmic corrections which are important. In fact, if I had kept, maybe I should have kept here constants because this does matter. So here, these vertices are u over square root of g each. So you get here that a u squared over g. Okay. So this constant that I didn't specify earlier is u squared over g. And what that means is that this gamma ends up being, parametrically, it ends up being u times m. Okay. So your peak is at m, and the width is u times m. But this u, precisely what you said, that u is auto-logarithmically correct, logarithmic corrections, actually this u, if you do an RG, this u goes like 1 over log of g minus g critical. Okay.
So Daniel, is it correct that this particular form of the self-energy, this lifetime, is strongly dependent on the fact that you chose those Cartesian coordinates and this external harmonic and this form, the coupling between the sigma and the pi modes.
Yes, it is.
Had you done something else?
We will do something else. We will do something else.
But also, if you take into account some vortex correction in your loop, or you don't have a vortex correction.
Yeah, vortex corrections are not important near the. I mean, this is the vertex correction. Actually, this is what gives you the 1 over log. You can think of that as the vertex correction. Right.
What worries me is not linear and omega dependence of imaginary part.
There's a sign of omega entering here. Okay, so it's all in omega.
Quotons, you know, due to analytic properties, you should have linear omega dependence.
But here you have.
Otherwise, it means some non-analyticity of your grid.
No, but there's all of these ultraviolet and and the infrared divergence. Actually, the important ones are the infrared divergence.
Close to the Kriegel positive, you have to have non-analyticity.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it means that you are not close to the Kriegel positive.
Right. Right.
The question is whether we at all can speak about poles of the propagator, or there is a branch cut.
No, there is a branch cut. But basically, if you want to know what the retarded fringe function looks like, you have that. So this is in the complex omega plane. You have a branch cut, but in addition, you have two poles. They're both below because this is a retarded fringe function. Okay, so they're both below. So you get two poles plus a branch cut. There's a branch cut because you see it here. There's a log. So,
Let's go on.
Okay. Let's move on. So basically, okay. So,
Actually, just one comment. So this model is, I think, is belongs to the class of so-called Lie models, right? This cubic interaction, and it's known that there are some pathologies like this branch cuts and so on.
But I think,
it's not kind of renormalizable.
Well, no, I think this theory is renormalizable, right? I mean, because
maybe it's 3 plus 1.
Just because of the symmetry, right? I think that the fact that it's coming from a spontaneously broken symmetry protects renormalizability. So, for this case, you just need 3 counterterms and they can absorb all of the infinities.
Yeah, but I mean, that if you take yourself only to this, kind of dissolve these dots, then probably it's not.
Right, I agree. Yeah. You have to keep everything. Yeah, I agree. So, So basically, this if you do the full fledged RG, what you get is that u goes to zero as its log, and so what that tells you is that as you get closer and closer to the critical point, the ratio of gamma over m goes to zero as 1 over log of g minus g critical. Okay, so basically the mass softens to zero, but the lifetime softens to zero faster because it's proportional to m times something that goes down to zero like this. So basically, as you get closer and closer to the critical point, the energy of the mode goes to zero, like this. So M goes like G minus G critical to the 1/2 because it's mean field critical exponents. And the lifetime goes to zero, so the mode softens, but it becomes sharper and sharper. And so we say that in three dimensions, the Higgs is a critically well-defined mode because, you know, the lifetime over energy becomes sharper and sharper. Okay?
I mean, but the moment, how can you distinguish it from the other, for the pi modes? I mean, because you are losing the Mexican head, basically, and you're becoming completely quantic potential.
Right, but if you look, but you can look at, you know, you can do an experiment that measures this. So neutron scattering, actually, this is measures this, and it is this peak, and the peak becomes sharper.
You really to look at how the whole thing evolves, and you get close, because, I mean, when you are right there, I mean...
Yeah, exactly, yeah, what do you... No, absolutely. It's how you approach. And that's actually what these guys did. They varied pressure, they did in elastic neutron scattering, and you know, that's a more complicated experiment, but they see
this something
more.
Isn't it strange that, again, reiterating his question, isn't it strange that you are essentially losing the Mexico half profile, and yet the mode which is related with the existence of that profile is becoming better and better defined?
Yeah, but its energy is also its energy is also softening more and more, right?
So. It's basically free theory.
Yeah, it's going to a free theory. Exactly.
You
have to look at it really as you get close, because once you are there,
you really go to the plus one dimensions.
Yeah, plus one dimensions, yeah. Yeah, let's...
let's go to plus one.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go to 2+1, and in 2+1, basically, everything that I told you here, you know, we could erase this plus one here, and... you know, everything that I told you here roughly looks the same. But here we see the first problem in 2+1 dimensions. Because now, this integral that was just logarithmically divergent, now it has 1 over k divergence. Just power counting, we have 3 powers of momentum, 4 powers of momentum there. And so now this looks like that. Okay, and if you analytically continue, you get that sigma of minus I omega looks like omega I over mod omega. So now you have that the lifetime is diverging as omega goes to zero. Okay, and so then, you know, if you look at this, you conclude that the Higgs is not a well-defined mode, okay, in 2+1 dimensions. And of course, what I'm showing you here is just first-order perturbation theory. You can do this much more carefully. You can use ordered entities to see exactly what happens, and and this is a very well-studied problem. So, and the conclusion is that in 2+1 dimensions, this sigma sigma Green's function does not have it does not have poles at all. It just has a branch cut starting from at least. Okay, this is a result from n equals infinity. Actually, sorry. More generally, it could have other things, but for n equals infinity, I haven't even told you what is n. But
the number of components
exactly. So if I runs from phi 1 to phi n, then this tells you that there is no sense of talking about the Higgs mode in two dimensions. Okay?
Yeah, but again, if I'm going to infinity, then your model is, you can cast it in the Gaussian form. So again, how can you talk about the... I see.
Yeah. It's you can do RPA, but but even weak coupling, I mean, this divergence of the lifetime at small omegas is there. That's robust. That you cannot get rid of. Okay. Okay. So now I think I'll make you well happy because now I'll show you what things look like in polar coordinates. Okay. So in polar coordinates. And by the way, this thing, the reason that we got into this problem originally is that these calculations seem to say that the Higgs is not well defined, but there were some computations of optical conductivity by Netanel Lindner and Asa Auerbach that showed a well defined peak at finite frequency that they identified with the Higgs. So we were trying to understand, you know, what's really happening. And so if we do this same calculation that I show you, but in polar coordinates, so now I'm just going to use phi equals to that. And so now the effective action, the action in these polar coordinates looks like this. You get 1/2 integral p3x del mu rho squared minus m squared rho squared plus del mu n hat squared times 1 plus rho plus some higher order terms. Okay? And so some terms that are less relevant. Okay. And so now we still have a massive Higgs mode, here represented by rho. And we have massive Goldstone modes. But now the interaction between the Higgs and the Goldstone has two extra derivatives, right? It has two derivatives. Basically, we have a rho del mu n hat squared. And of course, you know, n hat by itself could not have entered because n hat squared would be 1. So you need to have derivatives. And so now, if you go through this same calculation as before, what you get is that the vertices get 2 extra powers of momentum. Each vertex gets 2 extra powers of momentum, right? Because you have 2 extra derivatives in the interaction term. So in other words, if I compute sigma rho, which is, again, a diagram like this, but now this line is representing rho, and this is an n hat field, I will get the same diagram as before, but I will get 2 extra k's here and 2 extra k's there, and so powers of k. And so now, instead of getting a 1 over k divergence, I'll get a ke cubed term at low energies. Okay? So now this looks to be IR finite. And so from this calculation, you would say, well, the Higgs is a perfectly well-defined mode. Okay, there's nothing funny going on.
So if you do this in 3+1 dimensions, what do you get?
You will not get the log. You will get k to the fourth leading term. Hmm?
Okay.
So. Okay.
Here you are also assuming that you are expanding around the correct mass, right? So
yeah. I expand around this. Yes. Plus the tadpoles. Yeah. So here, you know, so there we said the Higgs is not well defined. Here we're saying the Higgs is well defined. Okay. So what's going on? You know, how can it be that if you parameterize your degrees of freedom in two different ways, you get two different answers? So the answer is that they're actually corresponding to two different correlation functions. What I just computed relates to two different correlation functions and therefore to two different types of experiments. Okay? That sigma-sigma correlation function basically corresponds to this sigma of.
I don't expect. We are talking about the action. Before you're talking about the correlation function, you're talking about the action.
Right.
And there is only one correct way. I mean.
There's one correct way, but the language is what's the problem. The language saying that the Higgs is well defined or not well defined.
I agree because the first way to write the action, the way you wrote the action here, you pretended that the pi was constant, but actually it was not constant. It had some mass.
No, the pi. Okay.
No, because it
in a field in a field theory things no in a field in a field theory you have a lot of freedom about how you represent fields, right? And you have to sort of go back to, you know, there's not a one well-defined way of representing things.
No, you can do whatever you want, but the pi is not massless in this expression because fluctuations.
No, the pi is massless. The pi is massless. No. A word identity protects that the self-energy of the pi does not get a mass. Okay, this is absolutely.
Now, if you realize the symmetry properly, then you were breaking the rotational symmetry.
No, I wasn't. I mean, the fact that I only wrote this, I don't want to, you know, you have to do it with other terms.
You know, the word that ended helps you.
Let's get to the punchline and then.
Then we punch later.
Okay. So, basically, this chi sigma sigma corresponds to this type of correlation function. Chi rho rho corresponds to this correlation function. This correlation function, sigma, is a projection of the order parameter in one particular direction. Okay? So this corresponds in the original problem of the magnet, it corresponds to SIA of T, SJE of T, times delta A x hat, delta B x hat. Okay, this is zero. This would be like the dynamical spin-spin correlation, but projected into the direction in which you broke the symmetry. Okay, mm-hmm. That's the. This guy would be more analogous to si dot sj for I and j nearest neighbors at t, sl dot sm nearest neighbors at zero. Okay, because here my order parameter is a rotationally invariant order parameter to begin with. Okay.
Wait a second. You are telling me that the 2-point function is a 4-point function.
Well, but it becomes effectively if you go to a continuum limit, it becomes so. This is a 4-point function, but in the field theory, this is phi squared.
Okay. It's even worse, it's a composite over
A. You expand phi equals 1 plus rho. And you get the rho.
Okay.
Yeah. Plus higher order terms that are less relevant. Yeah. So. Okay. Okay. So this is. So basically, what I'm telling you is that if you do an experiment that measures this, you will not see the Higgs. If you do an experiment that measures that, you will see the Higgs.
So, but by that you mean if you couple to the absolute value of your spin?
If I couple to something that's rotationally invariant. So for example, this would be like the local energy density. So for example, this
if it's a quality which is a function of the absolute value of the spin.
Yes, exactly. So for example, this top one could be neutron scattering. Okay, neutron scattering is sensitive to this. This bottom one could be Raman scattering. Okay, two magnon Raman, with some factors that I haven't written, of course, but it doesn't couple to specific directions of the spin, it couples to the local energy density. Okay? So that's the first punchline. Okay? The first punchline is that contrary to what was thought, that the Higgs is not a well-defined mode, if you look at the correct if you make the correct experiment, you can see the Higgs, even in 2 plus 1 dimensions. Mm-hmm. Okay? So that's
the statement was based on the fact that people were thinking that they were probing something, while in the field theory they were probing something else, basically.
Yeah, I mean, they were interested in, they equated Higgs with longitudinal susceptibility, but it's right.
So far, well-defined means that it doesn't have an IR cutoff, it doesn't mean that it's...
Right, no, that's true. So, but I can show you, if you do the calculation in large N, basically what things look like is... imaginary part of chi sigma, well, let me draw both of them. So it looks something like this. Here you have this 1 over omega divergence. So this here is chi sigma sigma prime, a double prime, sorry, the imaginary part. And the other one looks something like this, because here, instead of getting this 1 over omega divergence, you get an omega cubed leading behavior. Okay, so here you have a peak that can be that gets hidden by this divergence of at low frequencies. Okay.
So for the top one, if you go further away from the critical points, the peak also separates out.
Yeah, exactly. It's true that this is a qualitative. Well, no, it's a qualitative difference. You know, 1 over omega versus omega q. However, it's true that if you're very very far, if you're very deep in the ordered phase, this thing will look. You will get the 1 over omega, and in principle you can get this like that. But then the other one is always sharper. The other one, in this case, this one would look much sharper because you don't have any of this. So, but then the question is then also what happens near a critical point. How much time so I can plan?
Zero
time.
Minus one.
Okay. So maybe I can just use three.
Just say a sentence and.
Yeah. Okay.
Fine. Then whoever wants to say it.
Okay. Sounds good. So basically. Basically, when I told you what happens in three dimensions, I showed you that the lifetime is finite. And the mode gets progressively sharper, relatively sharper as you get closer to the critical point. The question is now: here we show that if we look at the correct correlation function, one can see a peak. But now the question is: what happens to that peak as you get closer to the critical point? The answer is that if you you can show by scaling that near critical point, this thing has to go like some non-universal amplitude times some delta d minus 2 over nu times some phi rho of omega over delta, okay, where delta is something that goes to zero as g minus t critical to the nu, okay? And so this is in general true due to scaling, but then the question is whether this scaling function has a peak or not. Okay, because if you look at the scaling function, what this tells you is that suppose that the scaling function looks like this. Phi double prime. Suppose that the scaling function had a peak. In that case, what scaling tells you is that as you get closer to a critical point, the overall size of the peak gets rescaled in some way. But then the frequency dependence only gets this, rescaled by whatever delta is doing. Okay? So if you have a peak, the width of the peak relative to its position will stay fixed. Okay? It will not change. So as you get closer and closer to the critical point, you do not have that. The mode is critically well-defined, but it also doesn't become worse-defined. Just the ratio of width to energy stays constant as you get a little closer to the peak. And so we've made some effort to compute this phi double prime first analytically in a 1 over n expansion, and then numerically, first of all, numerically, there's something that, there's some nice work by Prokofiev and Paulette, where they computed this and showed that there's a peak in phi double prime for n equals 2. We have some nice results with a grad student, Smir Gazit, who's done this also for n equals 2 and n equals 3, and basically also gets these peaks and also shows, once it's indications of how the large n limit is recovered. So anyway, that's just a sort of advertisement. Yeah.
Thank you. I suggest that we ask questions and then whoever wants to listen to more details is can have a discussion. Okay, so questions.
So you just said you have to go to 1 over n, huh?
Uh-huh.
So, the leading order, the problem is that this part. So the leading order for n will be 50,
right?
That's for 5 seconds.
Yeah, so I skipped a lot. So what happens is that if you look at this peak, now I'm just going to talk about chi double prime rho. Deep in the ordered phase, that means g over g critical, let's say, equals 0.1,
uh-huh.
You get a very sharp peak. As you get closer, this starts to become a little bit broader. This is, let's say, 0.5,
yeah.
And then even at, and then, you know, let's say at 0.9, looks like that. And basically the position of the peak stops moving down. Okay, so this is at n equals infinity. This is an n equals infinity calculation. The peak stops moving down. Okay? And if you compute this phi double prime for all, for n equals infinity, it actually looks like this. It starts as omega cubed, and then it just becomes linear in omega. So there, in that, so it has no peaks. But then for n equals 2, for example, you find something like this, and for n equals 3, you find something like that.
This is perturbative.
It's perturbative. So this is at order.
They are non-perturbative, and now you are showing me what is perturbative
It's to order 1/n. So
perturbative.
It's two orders in the coupling constant.
Yes.
But correct 1/n. I don't know what you call that, but yeah, it's also perturbative at n equals infinity, because you know, yeah. So. So yeah, so you, but you do...
And then, well, when you say n equal 1, n equal 3, simply that you have a perturbative solution, you plug.
Yeah, just plug in. But numerics substantiates that there is a peak. So, yeah.
And the scaling function is both for chi sigma sigma and for chi rho?
No, for chi sigma sigma is a completely different scaling function. Also a completely different scaling form. But for chi sigma sigma, you always get this 1/ω divergence, so there's no hope. For chi sigma. I meant chi rho. Yeah.
Other questions? Yes.
So, and in 3+1 dimensions, this phi double prime is a delta function?
Yeah, it's a delta function.
Okay, and I don't want to advertise that this has been seen kind of experimentally in visual experiments from Munich.
They're doing that?
It's called atoms.
You're talking about the 2+1. Yes, I forgot to mention that. So, sorry, that's an important point. That this Higgs, you know, I've been talking about all this, but this type of scalar correlation is the type of thing that Immanuel Bloch can probe by doing, you know, by modulating the amplitude of his optical lattice. He can basically look at these correlation functions, and he sees these peaks, and this is the peak softening to, you know, the way that you would expect for Higgs. So, I mean, that's probably the best. I mean, it's not easy to come up with a system that's strictly 2+1 dimensional, but in cold atoms, you, at least it's finite, but you can come up with something that, yeah.
Can I ask you something super naive?
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a 2+1 in 3-dimensional order parameters, say, if you would just have the sigma model, you would have non-perturbative solutions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if you add anharmonicities, would those be scaled?
If you had that what, sorry? I'm not sure. Also in 3, yeah. I think that they would be stable, but I don't know if they play an important role or not near the critical point in 3, in 3 dimensions. Yeah. But I think they are stable. I think they're, yeah.
Why?
But are they topologically?
I cannot fully see.
Yeah. So perhaps at this point it's already going too far in the continuum.
Okay, so thank you, and whoever wants to.
I'll also be around next week. So.